called Opening the Great Gates, Doorways to Liberation.
Vajra pushed before me up about giving this talk, and we talked about it, and we both agreed that it would be fairly straightforward for me to give this talk because, as Randy said, I've got lots of notes on the subject from various retreats. So is Vajra Pushpa, of course, but she couldn't be here this weekend. So it should be quite straightforward, we thought, and actually it hasn't been like that. hasn't been like that at all. Hasn't happened like that. I don't know why. Maybe it's just the mood I'm in, but maybe it's something to do with this time of year, because we have all just been celebrating Wesak and leading up to those celebrations. And so we've been celebrating the Buddha's enlightenment. And I think what I have in my mind from having done that various ways up in Scotland is just that we're celebrating just how vast its vision is. How vast its consequences are, its demands and its rewards. And to underestimate that is to dishonour it, I think. So what this talk is, it's an attempt to celebrate Buddha's enlightenment by trying to evoke, glasses needed, by trying to evoke a sense of making such a transforming transition in our lives that we can approach and move through the great gates, the vimokshas, the great doorways to liberation. It's an attempt to evoke what that might feel like, what it might reveal, what it might ask of us, what it might give to us. I just hope it works. But I learned a long time ago that Dharma talks are not about being original. They're more a case of sort of standing beside and drawing attention to what's already been shown. So I'm going to set the scene a bit for us. Actually, it's a little bit of a recap of what Gukhi Prabha said last night at the Shrine. I'm going to set the scene for us. And I'm going to use two texts just to try and help evoke this transforming transition that can help us move through the vimokshas. And in one text, it's the Buddha speaking to a young monk called Pukkusati. And in the other text, it's Vimalakirti speaking. In the first text, the Buddha's more talking about using impermanence and reflecting on no self to move through those particular vimokshas. And with Vimalakirti, it's more to do with the gateway that starts off with suffering and moves into biaslessness. So, this is from the piece. I don't know if you can all read it, but you can see it later. It's just to give us to set the scene. And it's a straightforward summary of what's in the Three Jewels, Nature of the Buddha's chapter. But it's all in one bit of paper. So there's the universe. The universe is, in this particular scheme, theory, made up of Sanskrita Dharmas, conditioned Dharmas, and asanskrita Dharmas. Conditioned Dharmas, then, come in two ways. There's the conditioned as it appears to be, and there's the conditioned as it is. It appears to be in certain ways because of our sense of I, me, mine, our ego centricity, our attachments, appears to be present, permanent, substantial, and beautiful. You know these are the four vipayasas. But as it actually is, unsatisfactory, not pleasant, but unsatisfactory, not permanent, impermanent, not substantial, not insubstantial, and not beautiful, but ugly, relatively speaking. These are the three, or four, latches. So we're exhorted to forsake these, understand the marks of conditioned existence, and then use them by reflecting on them to move through to a deeper realization where we really, really understand how things are, which are pleasant,
permanent, still insubstantial, and really beautiful. Okay, so that's the general framework. I'm sure I'm only recapping what you've put across before. So it makes it plain. This makes it very plain what the aim of practicing the Dharma is. Stop living in accordance with appearances. Start living in accordance with reality, and deepen our understanding, feeling, connection, heart connection with that as much as possible. There's a test of how well we're doing as well. It's not just all laid out in front of us. It's a test as well, because if you live in accordance with this lot, this bunch of four upayasas, what happens is our perceptions keep being contradicted. That's the test. Enlightened perception is not contradicted, because it's how things are. This is not how things are. Our perceptions are based on these, our perceptions will be contradicted. We suffer because of that. Enlightened beings do not suffer, at least not mentally. So there's a test, and then there's a method about how to move through these, and the method's meditation. So meditate how things are. So meditate, reflect on no self, on dukkha, on impermanence. So we've got it all laid out in front of us. Got a test, a method. Simple enough, yeah? Simple to understand, yeah? But something seems to happen. Somehow, it can all be laid out in front of us, but...
I was going to burst into song at this point, but actually, what I'm going to do is let George Harrison burst into song. George Harrison's last song. So you can take the horse to the water, but you can't make it drink. It can be all laid out in front of you, but that don't make you think. These upayasas, they're not just wrong information, are they? They're like we've been formatted wrongly. Deeply rooted, embedded. Not even just embedded in our consciousness, they are our consciousness. And to reverse them and see things as they are is a subtle task, I think. Subtle because the influence of the upayasas goes so deep, they may be wrong, but they give us the appearance of security, safety, control, independence. And also, I think, a subtle task, because I suspect that the upayasas are a bit like, you know, viruses. they can adapt. They are not passive, they can adapt. They can gain resistance in the way that viruses can. So we need to be able to eradicate them completely. Not be taken in when they start becoming camouflaged and plausible. Okay, so the first of the the first of the texts that I'm going to talk about, it's called the Exposition of Elements, and it's in Majjhima Nikaya. So the Buddha arrives at Rajgir. Oh, I do need them. It was. Asks the potter who's there if he can sleep, spend a night in his workshop. And the potter says, "It's fine by me. There is someone else there as well, though. So if it's okay by him, it's okay by me." So there's another monk there. And the Buddha goes in and says, "It's okay if I stay as well." And the monk is called Pukkasati. And he says, "Yes, yes, it's large enough. Of course, friend." So that tells us that Pukkasati doesn't recognize the Buddha. Thinks it's another monk. Well, it is another monk, but doesn't know who it is. So anyway, they settle down, and the Buddha makes a seat, gets a seat of grass made, sits down, and he meditates for most of the night. But he notices that Pukkasati does exactly the same thing. So they meditate together the whole of the night, most of the night. The Buddha is impressed. He says, "This monk conducts himself in a way that inspires confidence. Suppose I were to question him." So he does, discovers that Pukkasati says, "Yes, I've gone for refuge to the Buddha and his Dharma and his Sangha," without having ever met him, of course. And the Buddha says something like, "Oh," Pukkasati says, "Yes, the Buddha's up at Savatthi just now." So the Buddha then says, "Well, look, how about I teach you some Dharma?" So he does that, but without revealing who he is. So I just thought I'd take us through a bit of what the Buddha teaches to Pukkasati, this young monk. Because he says to him, well, a person consists of six elements. And he has four foundations. When he stands upon those foundations, the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him. And then he's called a sage of peace. So I had a particular reason for looking at this sutta, but when I read it, I just really kind of responded to that phrase, the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, because the tides of conceiving is all that there. So he says, a person consists of six elements and has four foundations, and when he stands on those foundations, the tides of conceiving can no longer sweep over him. And those four foundations are not to neglect wisdom, to preserve the truth, to cultivate relinquishment, and to train for peace. Not to neglect wisdom, preserve the truth, cultivate relinquishment, and train for peace. This is a summary of what then the Buddha taught. Now, one thing to note is that they spent the night meditating. The Buddha knew that Pukkasati could get concentrated. Both of them had actually been up in the fourth jhana. So when he starts to teach the young chap, what he starts in right away with is he teaches them about insight meditation, because he knows he can do samatha meditation. He talks to them directly about what the text says is about voidness, which is the foundation of arahantship. And he does that by teaching him the six element practice to counter the conceit of self. When that practice is done fully, then the Buddha says, then you're able to stand on these four foundations of wisdom, truth, relinquishment, and peace. So then he goes on and says, well, how does a person not neglect wisdom? Sorry, it's all negatives, but that's what it's like in Pali. how does a person not neglect wisdom? That's when he really gets down to describing the details of the six element practice. I'm not going to go into it, because Guhi Prabha led it through very beautifully already today. But the core of what he says, at least the core of what he says about the first five elements, are elements can be internal or external. We cling to the internal ones and call them mine. But actually, internal, external, they're just simply elements. This should be seen as it actually is, not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. This is the proper wisdom to develop. Thus we become disenchanted and dispassionate towards these elements, including the ones we call mine. And then the Buddha says, so when going through the five elements, it only remains for me to tell you about consciousness. Consciousness pure and bright. That's how he describes it. The first initial reason I had for looking up the sutta was because I never know quite what to do in the last stage of the six element practice, to be honest. I'll try and find something that will help. So I've been looking around to try and find some other sources of it and came across this one. So he says, the Buddha starts talking about the sixth element, consciousness. Now, when I read it, what I thought was happening was that he described the six element practice, and then he seemed to describe all these other practices, which I'll tell you about in a minute. A lot of it's mindfulness, but he seemed to then describe a lot of other practices, which seemed odd. And then I read it a few times later and thought, I don't think that's actually what happens. It reads like that when you read the sutta. It's like you're having descriptions of further practices. But actually, I thought maybe it's not that. Maybe what the Buddha's doing here is just describing what a mind is like, what consciousness is like when it's really thoroughly done the six element practice. It's just describing what naturally occurs. What naturally happens in the midst of this consciousness, pure and bright, radiant. So although it sounds like it's a whole set of other practices, and maybe actually would do us no harm at all to treat it like that, nevertheless, it does seem that it's not quite like that. It's more like something just naturally happens as a result of at least loosening or completely getting rid of this sense of I. It's natural. If the mind's released from the conceit of I, me, mine, yours, separateness, this is what naturally happens. This is what it's naturally like. And the first thing he describes is quite simply mindfulness. It's mindfulness of feeling. The consciousness recognises what's pleasant, experiences recognises or unpleasant or neutral, and understands, but at the same time is permeated with understanding that with the cessation of the contact to be felt as pleasant, then the corresponding feeling subsides and goes through the set of them. So experiences the feeling and understands that it's conditioned. Understands when the contact that's given rise to that stops, this feeling will stop. Buddha says, just like two fire sticks, presumably you rub them together, they give rise to flame and heat and fire. If you separate the two sticks, you don't get flame and heat and fire. Then there remains, he carries on, only equanimity, pure and bright. And then you get this lovely metaphor. He says, just as a goldsmith refines gold, prepares a furnace, puts the gold in a crucible, and then from time to time he blows it a bit, sprinkles water on it, or just looks at it, the gold becomes malleable, refined, wieldy, faultless, rid of dross, and radiant. And whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wished to make, that gold would serve his purpose. So too, there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. So that's a very beautiful evocation of what we might be to be doing the sixth stage of the sixth element practice. But he carries on. And he carries on, and he talks about entering the jhanas, and he's talking about entering the formless jhanas. He says, well, anyone in this state would understand that if they entered, he might want to enter the jhanas to develop his mind accordingly, says the Buddha. But then he'd have to remember that this equanimity of mind, if it were to be supported by or start clinging to these jhanas, it would remain there for a very long time. A very long time. And that person would remember, but all of that is conditioned. So the notes in the back of my translation of Majjhima Nikaya go into this a bit. It says that the Buddha is showing the danger of the jhanas and the higher jhanas and being caught up in them. They're still conditioned, built up, fashioned. Therefore, they're unstable and not lasting. They're subject to perishing, dissolution, blissful, but involved with birth and death still, and grounded upon suffering. Even the higher form of jhanas, grounded upon suffering, even then, they're not a shelter, not a place of safety. Suffering can still follow them. So, it's the second bit of advice he gives to young Pukusati. Kaizon says, understanding this, conditions or volitions that tend to being or not being are no longer formed. Clinging's not formed. He's not agitated. That person understands that the roots of suffering have been completely annihilated. At that point, the Buddha's talking about someone attaining arahantship. They understand that the destruction of ashravas. But still, he's saying that at that point, there's no longer any power in that person, that man, that constructs or builds up conditioned existence around about in this sort of way. Craving for eternal existence has been abandoned. Craving for annihilation, not being, has been abandoned, has stopped. So instead of that clinging volition, it's just feeling that arises. Its impermanence is just seen. Not even as a separate act, just there, part of it. There's no holding to anything. No delight in that kind of holding on. Detached from that kind of holding on. And he says that is the foundation of wisdom. Because it's founded on truth, it's unshakable and not deceptive. That's the foundation of truth. Before this transforming transition has been taking place, that person acquired attachments and developed attachments. But now they're abandoned and no longer subject to arising. That's the foundation of relinquishment. Covetousness and desire stopped. Anger and ill will stopped. Ignorance and delusion all stopped, all abandoned, all done away with, no longer able to arise. That's the foundation of peace. So those are the four foundations that a person can stand on as a result of thoroughly practicing six element practice. And then he goes on a bit further and talks about the tides of conceiving. They cannot sweep over a person who stands on those foundations. What is conceiving? It's all there in the sutta. I am is a conceiving. I am this. I shall be. I shall not be. I shall have this form, not that form. All of that is a conceiving. And there's no getting away from it. In this particular sutta, it's made quite plain. Carries on and says, conceiving is a disease. It's a tumour. Strong words and strong associations. But by overcoming all these conceivings, one does not die. One is not born, is not shaken, and is not agitated. So at this point, Pukusati recognises it's the Buddha. The first thing he does is apologise for having called him, addressed him as friend. And the Buddha actually tells him off a wee bit for having done it, which he kind of thinks a bit unfair, actually. But anyway, he accepts his, he also accepts his confession. And then Pugasati asks for full admission into the order, so he must have been just a novice. But it turns out that he doesn't have his robe and bowl complete. So the Buddha sends him off to do that. While he goes off to do it, he's killed.
Oh, no.
Yeah. He's killed. He's killed. We don't like it that he's killed. We'd already made up our mind what the end of the story was going to be. By a stray cow, as is often the case in at least the Pali Canon, hopefully not in India now, but the monks come and tell the Buddha, and the Buddha talks about Pugasati, and he described them as wise. He says, Pugasati practiced in accordance with the Dharma. He was no trouble to me in the interpretation of the Dharma. And he'd broken the five lower fetters. And he's now a non-returner. It doesn't say it in the text, but in the notes, it says he broke the five lower fetters in the course of this teaching from the Buddha. He hadn't done it before that. But I think what struck me about this, apart from trying to find out how to do the last stage of the sixth practice, was this phrase, tides of conceiving. And obviously there's an awful lot in it, and it is the Buddha talking about, or seeming to evoke what just the mind would be like in a person who's approaching some level of insight or is past that point. So what might we take from all of that? I mean, it might seem rather too high-flying a teaching, you know, for us to take too much from it. I mean, after all, they both start from the fourth jhana. Well, I hope I'm not maligning anyone by assuming that fourth jhana is not a common occurrence. Isn't for me. But I think there is a lot to be taken from it. Nevertheless, maybe rewind it back a bit to get to our level of practice. On the other hand, I don't want to rewind it back too soon. Because I think it goes with what I was saying at the beginning, that you know it's a tragedy in a way, if you look and you see people who don't know about the Dharma. You can see people's lives and they don't know about the Dharma, and you can see that there's suffering there that maybe is not necessary. That is a tragedy then, if you don't come across the Dharma. Well, we're all free from that. We've come across it. But it would be an even greater tragedy to know the Dharma and then lose it through underestimating its vastness, its beauty, and its demands. It would be a tragedy to settle for anything less than that. It'd be a tragedy to use the Dharma to fulfil our smaller aims. So this conceiving of I and me and mine, and then yours, that's the conceit that's there, that's the conceiving, and then there's all the tides that swell from that as a result, and then the tides are the viparyasas. So let's not mistake that the tides of this conceiving can be subtle, and cunning, alluring and persuasive. They can take us hostage and we might not even know that we're imprisoned. And they can certainly prevent us stopping, well, they are what prevent us stepping through the great gates of liberation. So a couple of reminders just to bear in mind alongside this story of Pugasati. One was, if you remember the words of the Buddha to Brahmasahampati, after Brahmasahampati had got him to think about teaching, and after the Buddha had the vision of humanity as it might become under the influence of the Dharma, the vision of the lotuses, And the words that are recorded of the Buddha speaking at that point, he said, "Open are the doors to the deathless. Let those who have ears, let them show faith, or let them show conviction." So open are the doors to the deathless. At that point, him deciding to teach, having become enlightened and deciding to teach, at that point, the Vimokshas are open to the rest of us. We just have to step through them, learn how to step through them, but they're open, unlocked. The doors of the deathless. So that puts onus on to us to have faith and show conviction. What there is to be won, you know, goes beyond what we can comprehend at the moment. We can't really comprehend it until we stop standing on the foundation of I and me, mine to be grasped, held, embraced, mine to give birth to. Unless we stop standing on that foundation, then we're not going to be able to comprehend what's open for us if we could but see it and move through. So long as we do that, we're swept away in the tides of conceiving. Tide rips, even, of birth and death. Volitions that tend to birth and death. The deathless, the doors of the deathless stand open before us, says Buddha. The deathless is to be comprehended by standing on the ground of wisdom, preserving the truth, cultivating relinquishment and training in peace. The deathless is also the beautiful, utterly beautiful. At one point, Buddha complained that Brahmins accused him of teaching ugliness. And he said, "I never did that. I don't do that. I teach that when one attains the release called the beautiful, then one knows what beauty truly is." So the deathless is the beautiful, the utterly beautiful and joyful. And I came across, actually, it's from the Dhammapada. I wasn't reading the Dhammapada, I was reading something else. And this was just a wee verse at the front of a chapter. It is from the Dhammapada. It says, "Whenever in your mind you contemplate the groups of existence, how they rise and cease to be, rapture and happiness you will attain. The one who knows it calls it the deathless realm, the birthless realm as well, the utterly beautiful." So, we've read number two. It's the same one again. It's just a different way of putting it. The tides of conceiving. I am, I have, I hold, I give birth to. But they're subject to perishing. Transient. Not a shelter, a place of safety. Suffering follows them. They're grounded upon suffering and involved with birth and death. That's what the Buddha's basic teaching to Pukkasati was getting at. To make this transition, he says, six element practice, it's about, this is not myself, this is not me. Mindfulness of feeling, just what's pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, knowing what gives rise to that, knowing that that ceases and fades away, not to be held to. Enjoyed in the moment, perhaps, but not to be held to. Mindfulness of impermanence, it's in recollection of conditionedness. And going from there through all those becomes the deathless, arises the deathless, the birthless, mind unshakable, peaceful, true, wise and purified like gold, the beautiful. It's presumably deliberate in his teaching that the Buddha concentrated on talking to Pukkasati at one point about the jhanas, because the monk obviously could get into the jhanas very easily. He'd been doing it all night. And the Buddha pointed out what was perhaps a particular danger to him. That might be a danger for some of us. But the way he pointed out was to say, remember that this is conditioned. If you get stuck in it, you'll be there a long time, even though it's very enjoyable. Just remember that it's conditioned. It can fall apart. Well, it will fall apart. Although it's blissful, it's grounded on suffering. So for us, it might not be that the jhanas are have that danger. But it'd be good to find out, or to ask ourselves the question, well, is there something else? Is there something else that I'm likely to want to subside into, be supported by, or cling to, be swept away in? Ask ourselves that question and just see what comes up from that. What is it that I cling to? Where do I rest? Where do I perpetuate my limited self? What traps me? What can I not relinquish? So we're going to leave the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, exposition of the elements, and move on to the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. In particular, the bit about consolation of the invalid. So I think everything that I've been telling you about that particular sutta, the Buddha's approach is more through impermanence and no self. There's not much about it in suffering. Well, there's suffering implied in it, but the main kind of edge that he keeps urging onto Pukkasati seems to be more through impermanence and no self. So the Vimalakirti Nirdesha goes for the other one, at least this particular bit of it does. In a sense, though, if you go through one, you find yourself involved with all of them, all the lakshanas and the mokshas. So Vimalakirti manifests himself as sick. I'm sure you remember that. He's sick because beings are sick. He's not sick in himself. He's sick because we're sick. I'm sure you know the story. There's all these bodhisattvas and disciples who are really reluctant, and that you get all these stories about why they're not going to go and see Vimalakirti, because they've been told off so many times. But actually, before all that happens, in the actual text, some of us recently were reading this text because we're on a study leader seminar on it. So before all that, actually, all the townspeople have no reluctance whatsoever. They flock to him to find out how he is, and I don't know, one can imagine the flowers and the bunches of grapes, but they flock to him, and he teaches them the Dharma. I mean, it's part of the skillful means, of course. But what does he teach them? He teaches them about the unreliability of the body, its impermanence, its insubstantiality. He says it's like a reflection because it's just the image of former actions. It's like an echo because it's dependent on conditions. It's like a cloud because it's characterized by turbulence and dissolution. Or a flash of lightning because it's unstable and decays in every moment. And then he goes through the six elements with them. Not the whole practice, but how it's made up of six elements. It says, certain only is its end in death. You should despair of this body, says Vimalakirti. Despair of it. Don't place your reliance on it. It's unreliable. What you should do is arouse your admiration for the body of the Tathagata. Now, when he says the body of the Tathagata, he doesn't mean the physical body of the Tathagata. He means the body of the Tathagata's practice. And he says it's the body of practice and wisdom. It's born of love, joy and compassion. It's born of discipline, and it's born of self-control, born of reality. So on this study retreat that we had a month or so back, we had an evening where we reported in one evening on what is it in our body of practice what is it in our body of practice that we rely on? So I thought that's quite a good counter question to the one that I've just suggested about the tides of conceiving, to try and find out which particular tides of conceiving are liable to sweep me away or you away. Kind of counter to that, maybe gives us a bit of a counter current to rely on, is just to ask, well, here's Vimalakirti saying, don't rely on this physical body. Rely on the body of practice. arouse admiration for the Buddha's body of practice, but we have our own as well. We can do that, but also acknowledge our own. So in our own body of practice, we can ask ourselves, what is it that we rely on in our body of practice? So we had an evening on the retreat reporting in on that. And it was very interesting. It was very quiet, thoughtful kind of atmosphere. I didn't hear everybody's, but of the people in the group I was in, most of us actually talked about our meditation practice or else reflections that have come out of our meditation practice that we rely on. So this is what he teaches the townspeople. Unreliability of the physical body, despair of it, and arouse admiration for the Buddha's body of practice. But then, of course, eventually, you know, Manjushri is persuaded to go and visit him. Well, I say he goes, but as Manjushri and Vimalakirti agree, who goes finally goes not. Who comes is not known to come, and who appears is finally not to be seen. But there they are, the two of them, not sitting together. Vimalakirti says, his sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it'll last as long as the sicknesses of all beings lasts. But he also says, whence comes this sickness for bodhisattvas? The sickness of bodhisattvas arises from great compassion. So it's two kinds of sickness. One is the sickness of beings because of our thirst for existence and because of our ignorance. The other, the sickness of bodhisattvas who see us in that condition and in whom arises great compassion. And that for them, that's their sickness in response to ours. So they're not the same, but they're obviously connected. Which kind of sickness do we suffer from? Well, maybe both. That would be good. Certainly going to be the first one, but maybe it could be a bit of both. Now Manjushri then asks a series of questions about this sickness of bodhisattvas. So that's what I wanted to draw your attention to. So in the other sutta, the Dhatu Vibhanga one, the Buddha told Pukkasati what to do to escape from the tides of conceivings. Here Vimalakirti tells Manjushri how to bear the sickness of great compassion. He doesn't tell him how to get well. He tells them how to bear with that sickness, how to develop patience with that sickness. Before doing that, check the time. Well, before doing that, some sort of introduction to that, just a bit of help with the beforehand. I just thought I'd tell you something some points and that came up on a question answer session that happened on the Terry's retreat with Bhante in April. I haven't noted who asked which questions, but there was various questions about bodhisattva ideal, because we were talking about that in the study groups. So someone asked, someone quoted something that Bhante had written, I think to someone, to Ranaloka, sorry it's very vague, but he'd said he hoped that they were experiencing stillness, simplicity and contentment, even in the midst of very busy lives. Because inner calm and outward activity are not necessarily incompatible. And said, being inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal is what allows us to transcend that apparent dichotomy. So the person who asked the question said, well, presumably that happens because through that inspiration and by acting on it, we become more selfless, and then, hence, there's less conflict. Bhante said, yes, that's right. That's what happens. And unfortunately carried on. And he referred to a book by Dujong Rinpoche called Counsels from the Heart. Now, he was quoting it from memory, and I haven't managed to get hold of the book. So you don't take this as being absolutely exact, but he'll certainly have the gist of it. And he just said that in that book, Dojong Rinpoche talks about the conflict between shunyata and practice, and says there's two extremes. In the one extreme, you lose practice in shunyata. The other extreme, you lose shunyata in practice. So that's all dujom, Rinpoche says. Bhante then started examining what that might mean. He said, well, the first one, losing practice in shunyata. It's the kind of situation where you think, well, ultimately, there's no difference between skillful and unskillful. They're both void, so, well, ethics doesn't really matter. It's all dualistic. And he said he thought that perhaps there was a tendency towards that in some Zen practitioners. Personally, I thought, well, we're too well taught, actually, I think, to do that. But perhaps not. One shouldn't be complacent. But, and that's the way in which you lose practice in shunyata, inappropriately. Inappropriately. But the other one, when you lose shunyata in practice, he says, well, we need to have the experience of shunyata at the back of our practice. Don't allow shunyata to disappear in all the busyness, in all the actual outward going practice, if that's what it is. And he says, well, the Bodhisattva ideal works because it doesn't allow shunyata to swallow up the practice of the paramitas, but it always lies behind the activity, just ordinary practice, because we're just involved in the ordinary world and we're out there and it is dualistic and that's how we see it. We're doing either our own personal practice or something that's a bit more concerned with other people, but we're just out there doing it. But always try and have something of an element of shunyata lying behind that. Maybe at first it's a balance that gets built up. And he says you could say that when Dojong Rinpoche talks about shunyata, he just basically means a meditative attitude. That we have a meditation practice in our life and we allow that to permeate our whole life even when we're not actually formally meditating. But Dojong says shunyata. So Bhante says, okay, well, maybe to aim with that, there's a balance that you build up. You do one, the meditative, more than the activity and the activity, and you balance them. But later on, it's not a question of going from one to the other, even doing it in a balanced way. It's a question of learning to be fused together, interfused, he says, not just balanced. Eventually, then, that's what the Bodhisattva attains, and it's what's called a non-abiding nirvana. Non-abiding because you don't settle into it for the sake of personal quietude and peace. So this whole conversation and these questions and answers. And then someone else brought in the point about the myth of Avalokiteshvara. Out of that, just to summarise it, well, we tend to think of tension between personal practice and responding to others. But in the myth of Avalokiteshvara, when his head splits apart, that's not really what's happening. That seems to be more to do with attention connected with seeing, with the seeming impossibility of solving the problem of dukkha. Now, I thought that caught my attention, that. The difference between attention between personal practice and responding to others. And the other one where there's so much tension at Avalokiteshvara that he thinks, oh, there's so much of this, I just can't do it. Look, I've hardly made any difference. And falls away from his vow. His head splits open. But that's not about personal practice and self another. That's about something different. So Bhante carried on talking about it. So on the one hand, you know, that you could say, well, there's inner calm, personal practice. We accept our ordination for the sake of enlightenment. On the other hand, seemingly, outward activity, responding to other people, and we also accept our ordination for the benefit, for the sake of all beings. You could summarise those as one being more to do with self, other one being more to do with other. And there is a tension between them. Of course there's a tension between them, because that's how we are, that's how we feel things. We feel ourselves to be separate. There's me here and there's all of you there and you all think the same. That's the world of appearances. And this can be a tension in there, of course. But this other tension that comes in seems to be more to do with that, the appearance of things, itself and other, and allowing a measure of shunyata to come into that awareness. So it's not so much attention because it's horizontal, but sort of, well, how I imagine it is vertical. That there's a tension horizontally, and no doubt we've experienced that. But then there's this other tension that's to do with shunyata. At least there's a tension there until it's perfected, until emptiness and skillful means are one. Up to that point, there's always going to be a certain tension between understanding that beings are insubstantial and working on their behalf. But that's different from self and other. But understanding beings are empty includes self and other. But still there's a tension there until they're fused. That polarity is between appearances and reality. If I help me, I help others. When that tension is resolved. If I help me, I help others. If I help others, I help me. Because there's no difference. Someone then at this point said, but look, the Bodhisattva ideal does always seem to be about helping others. And then we try to do that and we get stressed. And Bhante said, yes, that's what other people perceive. But from the Bodhisattva's point of view, he's not helping others. He doesn't see it like that. That's how we see it, but that's not how he sees it. At this point, Dhammadana, who was chairing this, attempted to summarise the situation and said, yes, well, look, there's us being inspired by the Bodhisattva ideal, but perhaps we don't quite do it on the level where, from our point of view, there's not others and we're not helping them. We do it on a lower level. And perhaps for whatever reasons, whatever conditioning, we've got a tendency sometimes to leave ourselves out of the picture. That's what results in strain. And Bhante's response to that was immediate. Yes, well, that's losing shunyata in practice. And then you need to rectify the balance. So we might need to think about that. Why is that? Losing shunyata in practice. It seems to me it's losing shunyata in practice because it takes a self-other as being really separate and then makes any, that's the first mistake, and then the second mistake for whatever reasons of conditioning might be there, giving all the importance and weight to other. I suppose it's possible to do it the other way around and give all the weight and importance to self, but in that particular example, giving all the importance and weight to other. So you take self and other as being really separate. And then being unable to step back from that and look at both self and other from the point of view of the other pole of possible pole of tension of shunyata. And in the end, it's not just about adjusting the balance or rectifying the balance. It's seeing there is no balance to adjust. There is no balance to rectify. And at that point, no doubt feeling all joy, beauty, satisfaction that arises when you really can do that. It's not what we think, of course. We think that if we lose sense of I, well, nothing will exist. We'll have gone into some, you know, a state of annihilation. Whereas actually what's being promised in this, all this is if we could really resolve that depth of tension, not just the one about self and other, but the other one between appearances and reality, that would open up, well, that opens up the vimokshas. That opens up the great gates of liberation. Okay, all of that was a way of introduction to then what happens between Manjushri and Vimalakirti. All right. Manjushri says, how should a bodhisattva console another bodhisattva who is sick? Console. Not get him well. How should he console him? Well, he should tell him that his body is impermanent, unsatisfactory, and without self. But he should tell him that the body is impermanent without exhorting him to disgust in it. Tell him that it's liable to suffering, but without exhorting him to take solace in his own personal liberation. And tell him it's without self, but that being should be developed. So point out the three lakshanas, but then put it in this bigger, far bigger perspective of shunyata. Encourage the bodhisattva if you're consoling him or her, encourage her to confess her evil deeds, but not for the sake of personal absolution, just to help, just to get back into a positive state of mind. Recollect that suffering, this suffering, is endless. It's been going on since beginningless time. Remind the Bodhisattva about that. And remind him that his purpose is to work for beings who are caught up in that endless suffering. So just remind him of that whole vast perspective. Encourage him not to be distressed. Just encourage him to manifest his own roots of virtue and keep craving at bay, and don't be distressed. Thus should he make the sick Bodhisattva happy. So, as if he's saying, look, there's no help for it. This sickness, the sickness of compassion, remember, is what we have to put up with. It's there to be borne. It's there to have patience with. The alternative, well, there is an alternative, but the alternative is to seek liberation elsewhere, abandoning other beings to the sickness of ignorance. With Pukkasati in the other text, the trap was the bliss of the dhyanas, and falling short of enlightenment because of that. Here, the trap is personal liberation and falling short of what his bodhisattva vow was. So that, in its essence, is how you. So that's how you console a bodhisattva. You don't send them a get well soon card. That's not the perspective. That's still probably in the self and other kind of level. You just keep reminding him about shunyata and tell him not to be distressed. Next question from Manjushri. How does a bodhisattva control his mind? Well, here again, it's all laid out in front of us. The sickness of beings arises from total involvement in a process of misunderstanding that's been going on from beginningless time. What's that misunderstanding? The misapprehension of I. I'm sure we've all got it now. That I exists. And then the further misapprehension that anything exists has inherent fixed existence. So sickness of beings arises from that total involvement. And it's got a cause, misapprehension of I, that I exists. What's the elimination of this sickness? Elimination. It's the elimination of egoism and possessiveness. And seeing that ultimately there's not even any difference between sickness and voidness. So sickness arises, it has a cause. That cause can be eradicated. How to do that? Develop compassion. Go beyond dependence on pleasure. Go beyond avoidance of pain. Go beyond internal and external. Go beyond dualism, but don't go beyond compassion for beings. Develop compassion based on insight. And this is another thing that caught my attention at this point. Well, it caught all our attention actually in this retreat I mentioned. Vimalakirti says, develop compassion based on insight, not sentimental compassion, because sentimental compassion only exhausts the bodhisattva. Those of you who've read that article by, was it Vishvapani, about the soreness, dharmachari or dharmachari soreness, that might be because it's based on sentimental compassion that is exhausting. So Manjushri is asked, how does a bodhisattva control his mind? And he just gets it all laid out again. And actually, it is in the form, I noticed it was in the form of a Four Noble Truth format, that the sickness arises, sickness exists. It has a cause, misapprehension of I and me. Here's how that can be eliminated. And here's how to do it. Develop compassion. But develop compassion based on insight, on shunyata, not sentimental compassion, which only exhausts the bodhisattva. And then they go on to a whole discussion, well, actually not so much a discussion, it's mainly Vimalakirti holding forth about what the difference between liberation, what's liberation and what's bondage. Liberation is where wisdom and skillful means come together, where shunyata and skillful means are together. Bondage is when you've got either one without the other. So sentimental compassion that exhausts the bodhisattva. I looked up this again. There's some notes about that, and from one of the translations of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. So I looked it up. Sentimental compassion arises from affective views that are based on self. Now, I think when we hear, or certainly when those of us in the study group heard that phrase, exhaust the bodhisattva, it does bring up all those kind of associations that Vishwapani dwelt on in that article about working really hard and then, you know, feeling exhausted afterwards and then possibly feeling resentful because of that and then possibly withdrawing it. It's the whole kind of involvement, withdrawing, kind of, that they're separate. You do the one, but then, you know, you have to go off and withdraw, not necessarily in a very positive state of mind, although at the end of that article I also noticed that he really exhorted us not to fall into those negative states of mind. So that's probably the level in which we kind of first connect with that exhaustion. It's not sentimental compassion that we need that's based on views, based on self. It's compassion that arises out of wisdom. And from the bodhisattva's point of view, it's not quite the same sort of exhaustion. Well, it wouldn't be, would it? It's not quite the same sort of exhaustion. It's because with compassion that's sentimental, he starts to feel aversion for taking rebirth, him taking rebirth. He starts to feel aversion towards that. He just starts to feel aversion towards carrying on being involved because it's exhausting him. And if he does that, of course, he falls away from his bodhisattva vow and takes solace in personal liberation. But if he avoids the aversion for rebirth, if he avoids these affective views and if he avoids sentimental compassion, then he's got the strength to deliver beings from their bondage. So that's more or less a chapter called Consolation of the Invalid. And at the very end of the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, there's a question, another question from someone else about Dharma worship, and it came to my mind actually at this point, thinking about sentimental compassion. What is Dharma worship? It's determining the Dharma according to the Dharma. It's applying the Dharma according to the Dharma. It's being in harmony with conditionedness, with conditionality. It's being free of extremist convictions. That's to do with being and not being. It's about attaining the tolerance of ultimate birthlessness. That's patience. That's the highest patience. It's about attaining patience just with how things are. And it's about realizing selflessness and living beinglessness. So I hope that looking at those two texts has managed to evoke something of what it just might feel like to be moving through that. Oops, oh, it's gone, it's on the floor, sorry. Transforming transition from the vipayasas, forsaking them, the lakshanas, understanding them, and the vimokshas and the meditation, cultivating them, realizing them. And Just at the end of the Consolation of the Invalid chapter, Vimalakirti holds forth a great paean of praise about what the domain of the bodhisattva is. So I'll just finish by telling you three of them. So the domain of the bodhisattva is where emptiness is reflected on, but where all kinds of virtues are also sought. Where signlessness is reflected on, but where the liberation of beings is kept in view. Where biaslessness is reflected on, but where the course through existences is voluntarily manifested. Such is the domain of the bodhisattva.